Smell it before you see it. That is usually how it starts. Something acrid cutting through the normal smells of warm aluminum and oil. And then maybe a thread of smoke from somewhere behind the panel, or a flicker of something orange at the edge of the cowl. You have maybe 3 seconds before your brain stops being analytical and becomes purely reactive. The question is whether those 3 seconds take you somewhere useful or somewhere not. I'm Pattern. This is Traffic Pattern on Radio Hangar. And today we are talking about in-flight fire, if that sounds like the kind of topic you already have handled. Just another checkride emergency category with a standard checklist. I want you to stay with me, because the National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, has documented cases where cockpit smoke incapacitated pilots within 90 seconds of onset. Not from the fire, from the smoke. And in those cases, the pilots did not run out of time because they lacked courage or knowledge. They ran out of time because they had not built the right reflex before they needed it. So let's build it today. Here is what nobody tells you clearly enough in primary training. In-flight fire is not one emergency, it is at least two. Engine fire and electrical fire, or cockpit smoke, have different causes, different checklists, and different consequences, if you mix them up. Most students memorize one set of steps and blur the rest. Let's separate them properly. Start with engine fire. That is the one most people picture when they hear the phrase. An engine fire in a piston single is most often caused by a cracked or leaking fuel line, a carburetor problem, or an induction system fire that results from a flooded start getting out of control. You might see flame or black smoke visible from outside the cowl. In a Cessna 172, you might catch something flickering at the edge of the cowling on your left. You might smell burning aviation fuel before you see anything. The smell of avgas burning is distinctive, sharp, and immediately recognizable if you have smelled it before. Your pilot's operating handbook, or POH, is the authority on your specific airplane. But across most training aircraft, the engine fire checklist follows a consistent pattern. Mixture to idle cutoff, fuel selector to off, throttle closed, magnetos off, master switch off, cabin heat and air off. Let me slow down on that last one because it gets rushed past in training. Your cabin heat in most small aircraft comes through a shroud around the exhaust pipe. If that shroud has developed a crack, and on aging training fleet aircraft, this is not uncommon, hot exhaust gases or even flames can enter the cabin through the heater duct. If you leave the cabin heat on during an engine fire, you have just opened a channel directly from the combustion event to your face. Turn it off. After those steps, you establish your glide at best glide speed, and you start looking at your landing options. Not airports, landing options. What is beneath you and in front of you that will support an emergency landing right now? And here's where I have to be direct about something. After the checklist, the expectation is that you land. Not that you begin troubleshooting whether the fire might self-extinguish, not that you navigate toward your departure airport because your car is parked there. You find the best available surface, you fly to it, and you put the airplane down. An active engine fire is not a situation where you buy yourself time by climbing. You are burning the clock and possibly the airframe. Before we get into electrical fire, let me mention our friends at aviationsoul.com. They make challenge coins for every step of the aviation journey, and I mean every step. First solo, private pilot, instrument, commercial. The milestones that mean something to people who actually fly. Quality pieces that hold up in a flight bag for years. AviationSoul.com. Now let's talk about electrical fire, and I want to say up front, this one is sneakier, and in some ways more dangerous, because it can be harder to locate and harder to stop. An electrical fire typically announces itself with the smell of burning insulation or hot wiring. If you have ever smelled an overloaded circuit or an electrical short, you know the odor. It is sharp and acrid, and nothing like burning fuel. Some pilots describe it like a soldering iron or burning plastic. Smoke may appear from behind the instrument panel, from the avionics stack, from vents in the cabin. Sometimes you smell it before you see any visible smoke at all. Common causes include aging or chafed wiring, a charging system problem, an alternator fault, or avionics components drawing more current than the bus was designed for. In older aircraft, wiring insulation degrades over time, and the inspection cycle does not always catch every failing wire before it becomes a problem in flight. The instinct most pilots have when they smell smoke and see haze near the panel is to start tracing circuits. Pull a breaker here, cycle a switch there, see if the smell changes. This is understandable. It is also not the first thing you do. The first move is avionics master off, then master switch off. You cut electrical power, you starve the source. Yes, that means you just lost most of your instruments and all of your radios for a moment. We will get that back. But the priority in those first seconds is to stop feeding whatever is burning. If you have a fire extinguisher, use it if you have an active fire. Aim at the base, not the top. Short bursts. Dry chemical extinguishers are effective, but they will coat your avionics and cockpit with residue that causes its own set of problems. If your airplane has a halon or carbon dioxide extinguisher, those are preferable in the cockpit because they do not leave destructive residue. Know which type you have before you need it. Then crack the vents or side window. Fresh air into the cockpit is not optional. Smoke inhalation, even brief exposure, impairs judgment, reduces visual acuity, and creates confusion. NTSB accident files contain cases where pilots made increasingly poor decisions in the minutes following initial smoke exposure. Not because they panicked, but because the smoke was doing quiet neurological work in the background. Get fresh air moving through. After the immediate threat is controlled, you begin selectively restoring power to get your radio back. One circuit at a time, you're listening and watching for any sign that smoke returns when you add a circuit back. When you have your radio, you declare the emergency. Let me stay on that for a moment. I have heard from students and from pilots on their biennial flight reviews that they feel a hesitation about saying the word. They do not want to overreact. They are not sure if it is serious enough. They worry about explaining themselves afterward. The FAA has made it clear that declaring an emergency in good faith carries legal protection. They cannot pursue certificate action against a pilot who declared and turned out to be wrong about the severity. What you lose by hesitating and being right about the severity is everything. What you lose by declaring and being wrong is some paperwork and maybe an uncomfortable conversation. The call is simple. Mayday, mayday, mayday. Your call sign, the nature of the emergency. Your position and altitude if you have them, your intentions. That is the transmission. If you are on frequency with a controller, say it to them directly. If you do not know what frequency you are on, squawk 7700 on your transponder and transmit in the blind on 121.5 MHz, the emergency frequency, until someone answers. You can sort out the details later. First, get the call out. Now, let me talk about what the Airman Certification Standards, or ACS, actually expect here. In the private pilot ACS, the emergency operations tasks include in-flight emergencies and fire. The examiner is not just looking to hear you recite checklist items in the right order. That is the floor. The ceiling is demonstrating that you understand why each step exists, that you have a mental model of what happens after the checklist ends, and that you can make reasonable decisions under simulated pressure. What I have seen on check rides is that students sometimes trail off after the last checklist item. The examiner asks, "And then what?" And there is a pause. Because the student's preparation stopped at the last printed line. The answer has to continue through the selection of a landing site, the approach considerations, the radio calls, the passenger briefing. The checklist is the opening of the story, not the whole book. Which brings me to something that gets almost no time in primary training, briefing your passenger. If someone is sitting in your right seat who does not fly, what are they doing during your emergency? Are they reaching for the door handle at the wrong moment? Are they grabbing the yoke? Are they frozen in silence, not knowing what to do with their hands? A 30-second passenger briefing before every flight changes this. Cover the seatbelt, cover the door latch, and add one sentence. Something like, "If I tell you to brace, I need you to do that immediately without asking questions." That is it. 30 seconds. A calm passenger who knows what to expect is worth more than almost anything else you could have in that cabin during an emergency. One more scenario worth walking through, because it comes up in training more than you might expect. What do you do when you cannot tell which kind of fire or smoke you have? You smell something wrong, you see haze forming in the cockpit. But is it the engine? Is it the electrical system? Is it something warm in the baggage area? In the first few seconds, you may genuinely not know. Here's a framework. If the smell suggests fuel or if you see anything visually associated with the engine compartment, treat it as engine fire and work that checklist. If the odor is more like burning insulation and the source seems to be the panel or avionics area, treat it as electrical. If you have genuine ambiguity, work the electrical fire checklist first. The reasoning is straightforward. If it is an electrical fire and you leave the master on, you continue to feed it. If it turns out to be something else and you cut the master, you have lost some equipment, but you have not made anything worse. The electrical fire procedure is the more conservative first response when you do not know. Let me close with the thing that matters most, the practice problem. The emergencies that go wrong are rarely the ones where the pilot did not know the checklist. They are the ones where the pilot could not access the checklist under stress. There's a difference between information that lives in your head and a reflex that lives in your hands and your voice. After today, I want you to do something concrete. Pull your POH and find the emergency section. Read the fire procedures, both of them. Then close the book and walk through them from memory. If you get stuck, go back and read it again. Then find your fire extinguisher in whatever airplane you fly and verify that you can reach it from the left seat with your seatbelt on. If you have an instructor you fly with regularly, ask them to run an emergency procedures review. Not just a checkride style oral, a conversation that ends with, "And then what?" until you have talked yourself all the way to the ground. The ACS will ask you about this on your checkride, but the test that counts is not in a conference room with a designated examiner. It is in a real airplane, with real smoke, and a very short clock. Sources today include the FAA Airplane Flying Handbook, the Private Pilot Airman Certification Standards, and Emergency Procedures Documentation in Standard Aircraft POH sections. More at radiohangar.com. Safe flying. See you next time.